There are two FDA-approved medications for tardive dyskinesia, but which one should you use? And at $80,000 a year, how can anyone afford them? Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psych MP and a dedicated reader of every issue. It was on April 11th, 2017, when the FDA approved the first medication for tardive dyskinesia, valbenazine, brand name Ingrezza. It was soon followed a few months later by dutetrabenazine, Austedo. The theory behind these drugs is that tardive dyskinesia is caused by a hypersensitivity to dopamine in the motor neurons, and that reducing dopamine in the synaptic cleft will stabilize that hypersensitivity. That is what these VMAT2 inhibitors do. They block the VMAT2 transporter, which ferries dopamine, as well as norepinephrine, serotonin, and histamine, back into the neuron so it can be released through synaptic vesicles. When dopamine can't be transported back into the neurons, there is less available to be released. Hence, there's ultimately less floating around in the synaptic cleft.
So that's a complex mechanism and a circuitous route to stabilize dopamine, but one thing it tells us is that the VMAT2 inhibitors are not doing the opposite of an antipsychotic. These are not anti-antipsychotics, and that's not how they treat tardive dyskinesia. They are not increasing dopamine. So there's no known way that they could cause psychosis. In fact, the early VMAT2 inhibitor, reserpine, was used as an antipsychotic in the 1950s.
Well, what became of that?
Reserpine caused depression and a lot of other side effects, so it quickly fell out of favor, both as a blood pressure medicine and an antipsychotic. And that is an understandable consequence of the VMAT2 mechanism, depression. I mean, depleting dopamine led to a depressed state. That makes a lot of sense. But reserpine was different from the other VMAT2 inhibitors in two important ways. It did not bind selectively at VMAT2, so it hit too many targets, and when it did bind, it did so irreversibly. Today's VMAT2 inhibitors are reversible inhibitors.
So the other VMAT2 inhibitors are valbenazine and dutrabenazine, right?
Yes, and there's also tetrabenazine. Both of these new treatments for tardive dyskinesia are really derivatives of tetrabenazine. It's a selective VMAT2 inhibitor that was discovered in the early 1950s. Let's go back to the 50s. This was an era when the antipsychotics were first being developed, and tetrabenazine was in the running. It was approved for schizophrenia in Europe, but it soon got replaced by the conventional antipsychotics, which were thought to be more effective and did not cause as much depression.
Wait a minute. You just said not as much depression? How do antipsychotics cause depression?
Depression was a well-known side effect of conventional antipsychotics before the atypical antipsychotics entered the picture. Back then, this is before the 1990s, thoughtful practitioners avoided antipsychotics and mood disorders. So it was really a sea change when they first gained FDA approval in mood disorders in the early 2000s. For example, in the 1970s, Robert Post helped discover the mood-stabilizing effects of anticonvulsants. I asked him once what drove him to do that. His answer, I didn't want to see all these people with bipolar get stuck on antipsychotics. And he was right. We have 8 studies showing that the risk of going into a depression after a mania is greater, about 1.5 times greater, if the mania was treated with a conventional antipsychotic compared to an atypical antipsychotic.
Okay, so the treatments for tardive dyskinesia might work as antipsychotics as well?
In theory, yes. It's never been tested clinically with the current ones, although the ones that it's derived from did treat psychosis. This points to a kind of obscure theory in psychiatry that's worth mentioning. It's this theory that the same mechanism that causes tardive dyskinesia, dopamine hypersensitivity, can also cause psychosis. This type of psychosis is called dopamine supersensitivity psychosis. There's about 100 papers on it, and the theory's been around since the 1970s. Basically, it's analogous to what we see with chronic benzo use, the idea that tolerance can develop at the receptor level, leading to worse anxiety when the benzodiazepine is stopped. The basic theory of dopamine supersensitivity psychosis is that an analogous thing can happen with antipsychotics.
Is there actually any proof of this dopamine supersensitivity psychosis idea?
No, there's not much proof of it. They have shown that it happens in animal studies, and in patients, the idea is supported just by basically clinical observations, but these are not controlled. There seems to be a subset of patients who have these three characteristics together. They develop treatment-resistant psychosis while on an antipsychotic for a long time. If the antipsychotic is stopped, their psychosis worsens rapidly, implying a possible withdrawal phenomena. And third, many of these patients also have bad tardive dyskinesia, which implies that there may be a shared mechanism of dopamine hypersensitivity going on here. But that's not anything close to proof. If you do see patients like that in your practice, it may be helpful to know this idea and to know the theoretical idea that the VMAT2 inhibitors could technically help that situation. But we're really getting ahead of ourselves because this is not anything that's been proven, just something to be aware of. And there are arguments against this idea. For example, in 2018, there was a controlled study of paliperidone withdrawal. It was industry-sponsored, and after the study was done, they did a post-hoc analysis where they looked back on it, and they looked for evidence of dopamine supersensitivity in the patients who relapsed off paliperidone. Bottom line, they didn't find any.
Okay, so we don't have to worry about these VMAT2 inhibitors causing psychosis, and in theory they may help it. That's interesting because they also share in common with antipsychotics a particularly vexing side effect where both can cause akathisia or restlessness. And you mentioned both can cause depression. Do we see that with the new VMAT2 inhibitors?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer is possibly. Deutetrabenazine, that's Austedo, did raise the risk of suicide and depression in Huntington's disease. So it carries a black box warning about suicidality specifically in that disease. Now, Huntington's already has a high suicide rate. 1 in 3 people with Huntington's disease attempt suicide, and 1 in 8 complete it. Valbenazine, Ingrezza, does not have that black box warning, but that's only because it's not FDA approved in Huntington's. It's likely that it would have the same risk as deutetrabenazine, we don't know, but if it was studied in Huntington's disease, I would expect it would have a same or similar risk. So, that leaves us with the question, is this suicidality risk specific and limited just to patients with Huntington's disease? Or is it just that it can cause suicidality in any population, and it only showed up in the Huntington's patients because that's a very enriched population to show this problem? And for those of you all who want the numbers, the risk of suicidality was 2% on deutetrabenazine and 0% on placebo. And that's just with suicidal ideation. But turning back to psychiatric patients, suicidality and depression did not show up in the trials, although the med that they're derived from, tetrabenazine, does have a 10% risk of causing depression. And now we're starting to see real-world data coming out where people are using these in their clinics and it's not as much a rarefied population. They're using it a lot in people with mood disorders. And in those studies, the more naturalistic studies, we're not seeing an increased risk of depression and suicidality. So I think it's still something to look for in patients, but it's not something we can definitively say that it's clear of or that it causes.
So if there's no evidence in any of the psychiatric studies for suicidality, then why do we even have to worry about it at all?
For one thing, the controlled trials we're talking about in psychiatric patients did screen out patients with suicidality. The manufacturers knew that tetrabenazine had caused a lot of depression and even suicidality, and they were really worried about this showing up in their trials. So their goal was to modify that drug, which is what they did with both of these, in such a way that it would hopefully not cause depression. So far, their trials were successful in that respect. But clinical trials are designed to detect efficacy. They power them with enough patients to be able to tell if their med is better than placebo. They're not designed to detect rare side effects, which would require a lot more patients. We spoke with Nasir Ghami about this last fall.
Conduct a clinical trial for, say, a drug to show that it's better than placebo. You power the study for efficacy with the drug. Now, with side effects in the same trial, you might look at 10 or 20 side effects. And the side effects might happen in 10% of people with one of them versus 5% placebo. It might be 3% of people for death and 1% placebo. It might be 30% for side effect X and 12% for placebo. You don't know. There's all kinds of variations. And none of those side effects is a study designed to assess. And so you run into both false positive and false negative findings.
Thank you to everyone who has completed the CME survey. We're almost there where we can turn this podcast into a CME publication where you can earn credits while you listen. And if you haven't turned in your survey yet, go to thecarlattreport.com/podcast survey because there's still time. As long as you submit by Monday, the 27th of January, we can use it to make those credits available to all. Okay, Dr. Aiken, we're back to the choice. Which of these VMAT2 inhibitors should you start with?
Thanks. I was talking a bit too much about theory there. That's a very practical question, and that was the goal of our article in the Carlatt Report this month. I looked at all the clinical trials I could find, but the two medications have never been compared head-to-head, so it's really a tough call. I read half a dozen review articles comparing them, but in the end, all of these articles basically said, flip a coin, they're both the same.
Well, you must not have read this one. Stephen Stoll wrote a review where he came down in favor of deutetrabenazine, Austedo. He admits that there's no clinical data supporting this, and so instead he focuses on their psychopharmacologic properties. Basically, his reasoning goes like this. Deutetrabenazine, Austedo, comes in three dose sizes, from 6 milligrams to 12 milligrams, and he estimates that you can achieve anywhere from 50 to 90% receptor binding at VMAT2 with those doses. Valbenazine and Ingrezza only comes in two sizes, 40 and 80 milligrams, but Stahl estimates that you'll achieve 80 to 90% receptor occupancy with those sizes. So the bottom line is, you get more flexibility in receptor binding with deutetrabenazine.
So basically he's saying that you should use deutetrabenazine, Austedo, because it comes in more tablet sizes. I see the point, like it would be easier to make micro adjustments to the dose if the patient had side effects and fine-tune it. And by the way, Stahl is a big advocate for personalized medicine, so I can see where he's coming from on this. But I gotta say I've never seen that used as an argument for choosing one medication over another.
I think I should point out that I looked this up on openpayments.gov, and the manufacturer of deutetrabenazine, Austedo, was one of Stahl's top financial supporters the past 2 years. The company that makes valbenazine was not listed as giving him any support.
Okay, well, Stahl and I agree on one thing. It's a very close call between these two drugs. And at the same time, we both appreciate that clinicians need an answer. Nobody wants to flip a coin in choosing a medication. So when I wrote the article in the Carlatt Report, I hadn't read Stahl's piece. Kelly really just brought that up today. And I came to a different conclusion. I think the winner is valbenazine by a very small margin.
Why do you prescribe valbenazine first?
Two reasons. Although they've never been compared head-to-head, when we look at the trials, valbenazine had a greater success rate. Looking at the number needed to treat, 1 in 4 patients responded to valbenazine, but in the deutetrabenazine trials, only 1 in 7 responded. The other reason is a lot more pragmatic. Deutetrabenazine, Austedo, is dosed twice a day, and it needs to be taken with food to fully absorb it, while valbenazine is dosed once a day and can be taken with or without food. In studies of depression, adherence rates are 3 times greater with once-a-day versus twice-a-day dosing.
You know, it really surprises me that Stahl doesn't address that in his article. In a lot of his other articles, he suggests that once-a-day dosing is better than multiple dosing, but those are articles supporting branded extended-release medications. However, I did find one reason to prefer deutetrabenazine over valbenazine. Deutetrabenazine is preferred by some Medicare plans, which is important because it's the elderly who are more prone to develop tardive dyskinesia.
That's interesting. Is deutetrabenazine cheaper than valbenazine?
No. If you take the maximum dose, which is 24 milligrams twice a day for deutetrabenazine, or 80 milligrams once a day for valbenazine, then valbenazine ends up being cheaper by a few thousand dollars a month. $7,000 versus $12,000. Part of the problem is that the patient needs 4 12-milligram tablets a day to reach that maximum dose, and they don't make a 24 milligram.
Well, either way, these are very high-cost medicines. We're talking $80,000 to $140,000 a year. We're not used to that cost in psychiatry, but we are moving that way. Esketamine Spravato is $2,000 to $4,000 a month. And brexenolone, that's the new treatment for postpartum depression, has a one-time cost of $30,000 to $40,000. Part of what I think is going on with the tardive dyskinesia meds is that the companies are using a rare disease pricing strategy, but it's questionable whether tardive dyskinesia is a rare disease. Congress defines a rare disease as those affecting less than 200,000 people in the United States. I've looked at the list at the FDA, and there are no psychiatric conditions on the rare disease list. The reason Congress defines this is that they want to encourage companies to make medications for rare diseases that may not pay off because the people who use them are so few. So there are financial incentives and tax breaks for companies that get medications approved for rare diseases. But tardive dyskinesia affects 500,000 people in the U.S., which is kind of on the border, so I can understand them doing this high pricing strategy, but it didn't allow them to get the benefits from Congress for a rare disease category. Although technically, the maker of Austedo did get that for their approval in Huntington's disease, which is classified as a rare disease.
It's true that Congress defines rare diseases that way, but not everybody uses the same 200,000 person cutoff. That can be good news for people with tardive dyskinesia. I found 2 charitable organizations. One of them was the National Organization of Rare Disorders, and their website is rarediseases.org. The other one is healthwellfoundation.org. So if your patient makes less than $60,000 as a single person, the cutoff is higher if they have children, they can get help through these organizations.
Tell us more about how to get these medications covered.
Most insurers do cover these medications. They're nearly all require prior authorization. However, I spoke with a few practice managers and they told me the process is pretty simple and the success rate fairly high. Each insurer has a different form, but there's a free online program called Cover My Meds that will fill out the form for you. Usually you just need to prove that the patient was diagnosed with tardive dyskinesia. Some insurers require you to do an AM scale and prove that the tardive dyskinesia is at least moderate in severity. They like to see an AIMS scale rated 10 or higher. You can get the AIMS scale free online. Just Google abnormal involuntary movement scale and the word psychiatric times. A few insurers require you to try a lower dose of the antipsychotic first to see if the TD improves, but you can bypass that if trying a lower dose would be contraindicated in your patient.
And that's not hard to prove, because with most patients, there's probably a time when you used a lower dose. Maybe you were titrating it up. Maybe you tried to lower it. In fact, it's really the best practice to use the lowest effective dose of an antipsychotic, whether in schizophrenia or mood disorders. We have data that people with schizophrenia live longer if they have a medium dose. If their dose is too high or too low, they don't live as long. So you should be trying to get to the lowest effective dose, and in doing so, you've probably already encountered evidence that the patient can only tolerate that dose and nothing lower. So, Kelly, take us through the actual steps of how you would prescribe this and walk the patient through the steps of getting it at the pharmacy.
Okay, here we go. When they first came out, the patient could only get them through a specialized pharmacy. So that's changed. Just write the prescription and have the patient bring it to the pharmacy. Warn them that a prior auth will probably be needed and that the pharmacist will initiate that. The pharmacist initiates a prior auth, usually through CoverMyMeds, and hopefully notifies you. And you or your staff complete the form to get it covered. Now, there is another way to do it besides CoverMyMeds. Both companies have an in-house program that help with the authorization process that's available on their websites. Some practice managers thought this worked better. They said it went through faster with these in-house programs. However, these programs require the patient's signature because you're releasing protected information to the drug company, so there is an extra step involved. The company also calls the patient every 30 days to remind them to refill the medicine. Both companies also have $0 copay programs available on their website, but these work for patients with private insurance only, not state or government or Medicare Medicaid insurance. So based on the patients that I've seen and the practice managers I spoke with, most patients end up paying copays from $0 to $30 for these medications, though sometimes the copay can be prohibitive. A neurology clinic published their real-world experience, and the results were similar. 94 to 100% of their patients got the drugs approved when they were used on-label, including tardive dyskinesia. Most of the patients paid $0 per month. A few of them paid up to $10 to $20 per month, but higher costs were very rare, and the most they saw was $1,000 per month.
As with most branded medications, there are also patient assistance programs that you can find on the company's websites. These will help your patients if they don't have insurance and if they generally make less than $36,000 a year for a single person. So after all this, we're still left with a bunch of patients that are not going to be helped by these VMAT2 inhibitors. There's the ones, for example, with a $1,000 copay. And there's the 3 out of 4 or 6 out of 7, depending on which meds you're using, who don't respond to it. That's a lot of people. Dopamine hypersensitivity, though, is not the only mechanism behind tardive dyskinesia. In our article online, we list 8 off-label treatments for tardive dyskinesia that work through different mechanisms. We also discuss the merits of alternative strategies, like lowering the dose coming off the antipsychotic, which is appropriate in some patients, particularly with mood disorders, switching to clozapine, which has no known risk of tardive dyskinesia, or switching to a different antipsychotic with a lesser risk.
And you can find all that at thecarlattreport.com, where you can get a $30 special offer off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST. The subscription includes the print edition delivered to your mailbox and full access to all of the articles on the website.
The Carlatt Report is part of a shrinking number of CME publications that operates entirely free of advertising and industry support.